From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Governor Whitmer has focused Michigan's attention on racism as a public health crisis. Today, what might some remedies look like?
I think there's obviously an opportunity to be self-aware about how you treat people who come in for medical services. You also need this other piece, which is to understand the context from which people are coming to you.
Also on the show, a deep dive into how the state's nursing homes have done controlling COVID infections. And we wrap up the week's conversations about food and systemic racism, checking in with two of Michigan's black farmers.
I don't personally believe in food deserts only to the extent that people haven't come back to what they really naturally should do is, you know, the soil and grow their own food.
All that plus a new Michigan-inspired cocktail coming up on today's show. First, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're going to explore what the state is doing to ensure the safety of patients in long-term nursing home facilities. That's just ahead later in the hour, but first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer this week reset the state's public health discussions, declaring racism a public health emergency. This triggered a set of initiatives to help eliminate racial bias in health and safety professions. To talk more about what the future may look like, we've invited Camille Bucette, director of the Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Camille Bucette, welcome to Stateside.
It's so great to be here, April. Thank you for having me.
When the governor of a Midwestern state makes a statement like this, did that create any waves in your field? Do you think people outside of Michigan noticed?
You know, people are definitely noticing, and not just because it's Michigan, but because it's really happening, you know, at the gubernatorial level, which is a very huge commitment. So, yes, it has definitely been noticed, and I think and really well received.
When we talk about racism as a public health crisis, what are the parameters that come to your mind?
So, you know, I think there are many ways about thinking it, many ways to think about this, but at the base is the fact that being Black or being Latino or being Native American in some ways disadvantages you in so many different aspects of life. And because of that, you do not have access to proper housing, to income that will allow you to afford places that contribute to greater well-being, access to healthcare, which is the one that, you know, is most obvious. You don't have the benefit of living in a community where perhaps there are lots of different opportunities for exercise and for communing with, you know, people of all different walks of life. So in some ways, being discriminated against in the way that it is done here in this country puts you behind in so many different dimensions of life that have direct impact on your well-being and particularly your health well-being.
What do you consider the most serious effects of how racism and implicit bias are affecting public health? What measures are you looking at?
So I would say the most direct effect, and you know, this is very literally about health, right, has to do with the ways in which Blacks, Native Americans, Latinos are treated when they come to a healthcare site. And there's a lot of data that's been collected over a number of years, many, many panel studies, that really indicate that the treatment is very different. It's different in terms of the actual initial encounter. It's different in terms of the kinds of advice and, you know, therapy and other sort of interactions that a person will have with a healthcare provider. It's different in terms of the follow-up, it's different in terms of the outcome. You see that in a lot of pain research. Most recently, there have been some very interesting studies that have shown that Blacks in particular have very poor pain outcomes, pain management outcomes, simply because we have internalized in the medical profession here in the U.S. that Blacks don't feel pain as much as white people do, for instance. There was recently a study that was just released, I think in the last month, that showed that children for a whole host of non-catastrophic surgeries, that children of color actually have a much higher mortality rate for the same types of surgeries, like an appendectomy or orthopedic surgery or something like that, than do white children who have had similar procedures. So those are some of the things that we look at.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that Governor Whitmer has proposed. She's committed to a Black Leadership Advisory Council and for implicit bias training for all employees under her leadership. Do those sound like appropriate first steps to you?
They do. You know, that's a, you have to start somewhere. And I think she has been, you know, taking a great leadership role in starting there. And I would say that having the Leadership Advisory Council is important because what she's doing is she is raising voices to a level where they can have impact on policy. And that's important because often you don't see that. And then secondly, the training, the implicit bias training is, of course, important in, you know, every state institution should embrace that, particularly now that we are in the middle of a national conversation on race and equity. But that's a very important place to start as well.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that. But, you know, you've written about the fact that this problem is not new. It has been identified at even as high as the federal level before. What comes to your mind when we talk about public policy initiatives that, you know, clearly have been discussed in the past that might have some impact in moving the needle, things that would that might you know, combine with state and local efforts to really make a difference?
So, you know, one way I think about that particular question is more in terms of how do we frame the questions rather than the particular solutions. And the reason I'm saying that, April, is that sometimes the solutions have to be very location specific, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes, you know, there has to be an overarching set of solutions that will be helpful for everyone. So, for instance, in the overarching category, how we treat young Black boys in preschool and shuttle them off. In what has, you know, been known as the school to prison pipeline, but shuttle them off down a disciplinary pathway that eventually gets them to be interacting with the justice system and law enforcement, et cetera. So that would, you would want to get overarching policy solutions for a system like that, which is obviously nationwide, even though the application of that might start, you know, in preschool. But there are going to be other solutions where it is very location specific. So when I think about how you frame problems, I think this is where it's important to have that advisory council because, for instance, one of the ways we often think about things like unemployment and income is people who are unemployed, they need to up their game in terms of their skill set. That they need to be more willing to take jobs that are further away. But we may want to frame it now that we are thinking about race and equity and racial justice. We may want to frame that in terms of what are the barriers that are not self-made that we have to address in order to make it easier for somebody who is very ambitious to be able to get a job that is commensurate with his or her skill set. So I think that framing piece is very, very important and actually probably more important than looking across at other locations for solutions that may have worked in that particular locale.
Camille, I think a lot of Michiganders were very aware that the governor was pointing to real-time examples from the pandemic when she made this announcement. I think many people also wondered how much can be done during this moment, a generational sort of triple crisis for the healthcare system, the economy, and just the moment of institutional crisis that's happening because those factors combine. Is this the right time to make it a starting point for deep systemic change?
I think it is. I think it is for a number of reasons. And, you know, governors have a good way of being able to understand the public mood and the public moment. And, you know, so I think they have an intuition that actually serves them well. So I would say that this is a good moment to start that conversation. But what you, in order to actually have long-term impact, you have to put into place a number of things that make that work sustainable over time. Because, you know, as you just mentioned, a lot of these problems are, you know, decades, if not longer, in the making. And so one of the things I would say about where Governor Whitmer has started is that I think it's a great starting point, but I would add to what she has done, that when she works with her advisory council and when she works across the state agencies, that she develop a set of goals that can be measured, for which there is going to be data collected and for which there is an end point. So, you know, a goal could be, we are going to reduce maternal mortality among Black women in the next 3 years by 25%. That's a goal and it's measurable, right? So you need to have several things like that. And the timeline needs to be, you know, fairly short. So like we have to follow the political calendar. Political calendars tend to be pretty short. And I would say you're talking about a 2 to 3 year period. To that, I would add that there we have to know who's accountable for those goals and those metrics. And that's tricky in, you know, when you're dealing in with policy and politicians and a range of equities there. And the last thing I would add is that, you know, when we talk about racism being a public health crisis, we're not just talking about health. And if you've noticed in my answers, I'm not limiting my answers to health. That's because health is now considered, health and well-being is considered to be the outcome of a range of social determinants. So when the governor is talking about wanting to address this public health crisis, she will need to do that across a variety of different agencies and across a variety of different kinds of partners. So when you think about housing, you think about the built environment, you think about, you know, how much money people have to live on, you think about the ways in which education does or does not serve the entire population of Michigan. These are just some examples about of how interlinked those particular areas are with health outcomes.
Camille Bucette directs the Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Camille, it's a pleasure talking to you.
Great, April. Thank you so much.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've been talking about food this week with respect to communities of color and the ways that systemic racism has a hand in shaping what we eat, how we eat it, and how we get what we eat. Did you know that fewer than 2% of America's farmers are Black? That's a pretty staggering statistic under any circumstances, but maybe especially in light of Black people's enslavement as the cornerstone of America's agricultural economy and the subsequent history of Black sharecroppers. Today, we've invited two farmers who've made their mark in agriculture for their stories and for some ideas about change. Barbara James Norman is a fourth-generation blueberry farmer in Covert, on the west side of Michigan. And just to note, as you're listening, that we had some problems with our internet connection. You probably hear some glitches through the course of the interview. All the same, Barbara, very glad to have you. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, and it's good to be here.
We're also talking with Malik Yakini. He's the executive director of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and also one of the leaders responsible for D-Town Farm. That's a 7-acre organic operation in Rouge Park. Malik, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start out by asking you both, we're in this moment when a growing number of people find themselves at home, find themselves with some time on their hands. And, you know, maybe they've been headed outside into the backyard. And I don't mean to compare what you two do, you know, full-time farm work is not the same as a backyard grow, but what do you think it is that attracts people so much to growing right now? Malik, do you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. So I'll start by saying that I both grow at D-Town Farm, and also this year, primarily because of the pandemic and having more time at home, I'm doing more in my family garden. And it's very therapeutic, first of all. Let's start with that. You know, you're outside, you're getting fresh air, you're getting sunlight. all of which are essential for good health. But also on a deeper level, most indigenous cultures understand that the earth is alive. The earth is not just the third stone from the sun. And there's energies that are emitted from the earth that we really need contact with for us to be whole and healthy. You know, this is an old understanding, but now in modern times, people are calling this grounding. You know, when people go outside with no shoes on or stand on the earth. And there's been a lot of evidence that even for things like attention deficit disorder, that children spending time outside on the earth helps to remedy the ADD. So connecting with the earth is absolutely essential. And there's something, I think there's some primordial urge that we have that leads us to connect with the earth in various ways, which is why people like doing things like camping and picnics and things like that, where we get a chance to, for those of us who are city dwellers, to kind of come out of buildings and concrete and reconnect with the natural world.
For sure. Barbara, again, I know there's a vast difference between a working farm and the backyard grow, but what comes to your mind when you hear and see people talking about their own grows at home?
The differences aren't that much difference when you get down to it, it's because it's all about producing food. And the old saying, you are what you eat. So it's no difference than with what Malik does in Detroit within the soil than what I do in COVID in the soil, only maybe the size. And I think it's so important now because people want to know where their food comes from. People are getting away from the chemicals. And I grew up knowing that if your soil is perfectly balanced or right, if you got to have good soil health, you need good body health, and all that comes from growing food and eating good and healthy. And I can do the same thing. I can grow lettuce on a porch in Detroit or in a backyard garden in Minnesota. You can feed Detroit with the soil right there in Detroit. And because I don't personally believe in food deserts only to the extent that people haven't come back to what they really naturally should do and grow their own food.
Barbara, I wanted to ask, how's the blueberry crop this year?
A little different. It's one of the years that maybe people will kind of, with the fruit and all of it, because of the weather or different things, it wasn't as bountiful as some years, and it wasn't as long as some years. A lot of crops are, fields are already finished.
Yeah.
But I don't complain when it's not a bumper crop. I use what I have and be thankful.
Barbara, you're the fourth generation in your family to run the farm. Can you tell us a little bit about how your family came to live in Covert?
We're celebrating our 75th year on this land.
My
grandparents were from Mississippi, and my grandfather was the first of 9 sons, a total of 12 siblings out together to move to come to Chicago with an uncle. But when it came time to move my great grandparents up here, he couldn't do the city. He needed someplace. So they started traveling in the summers just for my great grandfather to have someplace to do fruits and stuff. And so they leased this land for several years before purchasing it in August of 1945.
Wow. Barbara, I know you grew up on the farm and were surrounded by this life from a very young age. Malik, you grew up in Detroit. Would the young Malik Yakini ever thought of farming as a career that he would pursue?
No, it never crossed my mind. And you know, one of the reasons is because farming is not really valued in society. So rarely do you hear parents saying to their child, Johnny, I want you to grow up and be a farmer. So I think, you know, we were steered away from things like that, you know, particularly in urban areas. But even with that, as I look at what I'm doing now, the seeds of this were planted as I was a child. And my first exposure to gardening was actually in my grandfather's backyard, who had come up from Georgia in the early 1920s. And, you know, most folks from the South, you know, as Barbara just talked about, agriculture was part of their culture and they wanted to keep that as part of what they did on a day-to-day basis. So my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, always had a garden in his backyard. And I used to spend time in that garden as a young child with him. And I'm sure that planted the seeds that have sprouted in what I'm doing now with gardening and farming.
How did you become interested in doing this work as an adult?
Well, you know, I grew up in the 1960s and kind of 60s and 70s and was radicalized as a young person in Detroit. 1969 was 2 years after the Detroit Rebellion. And so this kind of very rebellious spirit was still in Detroit. And I was fortunate to go to a school, post-junior high school, where I had teachers who exposed us to Malcolm X records, the speeches of Malcolm X, and had us reading Black Panther Party newspapers. And so it really politicized me at an early age. And so I've always been interested in Black people being able to be more self-reliant, being less dependent upon others, and having more power to control our own destiny. So for many years, I was involved in other aspects of Black community empowerment. And, you know, it became apparent to me that food is a necessary part of that. We can't have freedom if we're not able to feed ourselves. You know, initially, my interest in food was on a personal level. I'm a vegan and have been for 40 years or so. And so I was very interested in how food impacted my personal health. But then later I began to understand how it fits into the whole social, political, economic realm. And for the last 20, 25 years or so, I've been pretty deeply involved in agriculture.
Malik, what would you say? How have you seen farming work as a tool for change in people's lives, maybe moving them closer to a place of social justice?
One of the things I've seen is that farming actually produces results. Many of the other kinds of activities I've been involved in as an activist, we go to dozens and dozens of meetings, and then sometimes you can put the results of those dozens of meetings in a teaspoon. But right. with farming and gardening, generally there's some relationship between the amount of effort you put into it and what you get out of it. You get some tangible outcomes. And so that's tremendously motivating for people, you know, like for children, if they plant carrot seeds and they can stick with it for, you know, 3 months and see that seed that they planted grow into an actual carrot, it's transforming because they begin to understand something about their own power and how when we meld our own power with the miraculous power of nature, we can produce these results.
Malik, could you say a little bit about the topic of food sovereignty? I mean, maybe first of all, just explain what it is and whether that is a goal that you work with people to actually achieve. I mean, anybody who's even dabbled in backyard gardening knows, you know, how much work it can be. Is that a goal that you try to encourage people to reach for?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, although our organization is called the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, we realized fairly early on that what we're really working towards is food sovereignty. And the difference in food security and food sovereignty is that food security at the most basic level is just making sure communities have enough food to eat, which is important. But as a friend of mine, Raj Patel, said, you can have food security in prison. You can be in prison and have enough food to eat. So obviously we're struggling for something more than that. So what we're interested in is how do we have control over the system that provides our food? You know, in Detroit, for example, Detroit is probably the blackest city in the United States with at least an 80% African-American population, but there's not one African-American owned grocery store. And so, you know, 600 some thousand black people in the city of Detroit are dependent upon people of other ethnicities who come into our community and set up what they call grocery stores and what I call wealth extraction stations to suck millions and millions of dollars out of our community. And if we were able to capture those millions of dollars we're spending on food, we could circulate that money to create the institutions and the infrastructure that we need in our community to have healthy, resilient communities. So we're interested in the whole process, not just making sure people have enough food in their stomach. We're interested in making sure that we're controlling the whole food system and we're benefiting from the tremendous amount of money that is spent on food.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Malik Yakini with the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network and also D-Town Farm. And we're also speaking with Barbara James Norman, a fourth-generation farmer in Covert. Barbara, we know that 98% of farms across the United States are owned by white families. That's a pretty astonishing number. What is it like to farm today in an industry that is so overwhelmingly white?
I love it. I love it for different reasons. Not because I think that the playing field level. I know that it's not. And just like the difference in big town Detroit, small town Colbert, you're talking a town where there's no red lights, no railroad tracks, no tall buildings. But you're talking a town that's never been segregated. So it's different, but there are some similarities.
So we heard you talk about Covert and how, you know, it's really a different kind of small town community than a lot of other places are. But what's the larger context when you're moving outside of your hometown in the context of the larger farm economy?
It's amazing because I can relate and I've done it. I found barriers are kind of similar, be you black, white, Indian, polka dot. Barriers are barriers. And so we have to change as the times change. And that's the difference of being from this little small town. Anywhere in the country that I go, I have similarities. I can relate. So you just got to do the work, like Malik said, and you've got to grow healthy food. If I'm in my backyard and putting Roundup and chemicals on everything, I'm going to get the same results if I'm a giant farmer and putting Roundup on my whole crop. It's all about good, healthy food and having what you want to eat and what you need to eat and being in charge of it. You know, my grandfather always taught me that he who owns the land makes the rules.
Makes the rules.
Right. And then he taught me when he used the word farmer, he says, a farmer, baby, we get the first count. We get the best of everything. We get the ripe, the first ripe tomato. We get the first apple. So I was taught these lessons. And when you're in the soil working, it's a soothing, it's a feeling. I got the lessons, didn't know that I would be afforded this opportunity to apply them to people across the country or anywhere I go and meet a lot of friends who are interested in being in charge of their body. And now that is growing because people are more interested in what's going in their body. They're not counting on the big Walmarts or the Myers or the Tyson people to give me food for my body.
Right. I have a question that I'd like to put to either of you who might have some thoughts about it. What do you see as some of the biggest barriers to more Black people entering farming? And what might it take to bring more folks into the industry? Barbara, would you like to start that one?
Okay, I have it in a nutshell. Lack of knowledge. We're not aware of the agriculture world. We're not aware of how profitable it is financially, spiritually, health-wise. It's all because we don't know. Knowledge is the same as whether I can read or write. If I have the right knowledge about agriculture, then I can be successful and more people will go into it.
Malik Yakini, anything to add there?
Yeah, well, I agree with Barbara that, you know, one of the big shifts that needs to take place is kind of a cultural shift, which would include our knowledge about farming and all the things she just mentioned, but also kind of how we view farming. Because for Black people in particular, many of us still have this stigma about farming because we associate it with slavery, with our enslavement. And so I've had many experiences working with young people where we have them at our farm or in a garden. And within the first 15, 20 minutes of them working, they make some reference to slavery. I've had similar experiences with young people who grew up in the Caribbean. So many Black folks in the Western Hemisphere associate farming with enslavement.
Is that disheartening to you, Malik?
Is it disheartening? Well, I mean, it's the reality that we're faced with. So I'm not disheartened by it. I just know the work that we have to do to shift that around. And also, there's a culture shift that needs to be made in American society in general. As I mentioned earlier, very few parents, you know, tell their children, I want you to grow up and be a farmer, because people don't value farming in the same way that they value these white collar professions, although the whole society is dependent upon farmers. But also there's issues about land ownership. There's been historical discrimination in terms of Black people buying land. A Black land loss that's continuing to this day, Black farms being foreclosed on. We have the whole history of the USDA discrimination in lending. And so we have this whole historical legacy of advantage that white farmers have had that black farmers have not had because of unfair lending practices. Financing continues to be an issue for black people, not just in farming, but in every area of society, because wealth is concentrated in the hands of white people. And anytime black people go to try to get financing for something, it's always much more difficult to get it. There's been discrimination in terms of seeds, having access to seeds. Sometimes folks haven't even been able to buy seeds from certain companies. There's problems with the markets, with who you sell to. There's the problems of scale. Some markets only want to buy on a certain scale that's very hard for farmers to produce at, for smaller farmers to produce at. So there's multiple impediments that that black farmers have. But none of these things should stop us from doing it. And if we work collectively, we can overcome all those problems.
Malik, a lot of people are aware that Detroit has more open land than a lot of other cities we could talk about. How hard is it for people who want to turn that land into food production to actually get it?
There's still quite a bit of difficulty with that. The city of Detroit has a program where if there's a vacant lot next to a house that you own and your taxes are paid up to date, that you can buy the vacant lot next to your house, I think, for $200. But that counts out renters. It counts out people whose taxes are not up to date, which is a huge segment of the Detroit population. The other thing, the city has a program where they'll let people use lots to do growing on, but the agreement is only for 1 year. And so you have to get that agreement renewed each year. And the thing about farming is, as Barbara said, the most important thing is the soil. And so if you develop the soil, you put all kind of organic matter in it and compost, then you don't want to have to move after a year or two, because this development of the soil is a multi-year process. So there's been some advancement in Detroit in terms of the elected and appointed officials understanding how urban farming fits into the whole kind of planning of what the city can be. But there's still a lot of confusion, still a lack of transparency, still kind of an uneven application of the policies. I want to mention, though, that our organization, along with Keep Growing Detroit and the Oakland Avenue Farm, just recently launched the Detroit Black Farmer Land Fund, where we've raised something like $60,000 so far to help black farmers in Detroit purchase land either that they're farming on currently or that they would like to farm on.
Both of you spend a lot of time helping other people who want to farm. I'd like to ask both of you as we wrap this up what maybe the most important lesson is that you can impart to a young farmer right now. Barbara, would you start us out?
Yes. Owning land, keeping some land, don't sell your land, and the importance of land. You've got to decide, just like the culture change, it starts at the root. Sometimes we want to wait. We want to start somewhere the person is not. You've got to teach them the value of the land, teach them what to do with the land, and just make it be important. But you've got to do it in a way that it means something to them. Teach them about agriculture. Teach them to grow something. Let them grow one thing. I would start with just that educational piece of the culture and about nature.
It's so interesting to hear you say how important it is to hold on to the land. I know that that's a concern that a lot of white farmers grapple with these days as they see the creep of suburbia and, you know, trying to make good decisions for their family about whether or not they should stay in the game or whether they should sell. I can only imagine those pressures are twice as hard for black farmers to navigate.
Well, if you remember my opening statement, barriers are the same. Maybe they squeeze us a little harder, but that's because we've been, the black culture has such a strength to them. And, you know, I look at all the things with people coming over, the Hispanics or the Germans or whatever. We were the only ones that came back for us. We wasn't allowed to decide, oh, there's an America over there we want to go. We are survivors. We are strugglers. And you have to instill that pride in people of color too. This would have been my seventh year for 100 Detroit students coming here. every year to do berries and have an ag day. But I had a kid here 2 years ago, was a junior in high school. And he says, you know, I've saw him on the roadside dead and in pictures, but he wanted to see a live deer walking through the path in the woods, made him think of that. And so things like that, you've got to expose people and children.
Malik, what would you say if a young farmer was looking for you know, one big takeaway to show them through this?
So it's always difficult for me to answer when people ask about, you know, what is the one thing?
There's not one thing, yeah.
But one of the things that I think is really important is that we live in a culture where people are used to things being instant, and people have short attention spans, you know, everything is in small sound bites. People are living in the short term, and farming really is a long term commitment. So, you know, changing our mindset from this culture of instant things happening to beginning to think in years and decades is the advice that I would give to new farmers.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us today. It's great to hear your voices and everything you have to say, and that you're both doing well. We've been speaking with Malik Yakini of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network and D-Town Farm, and also with Barbara James Norman from Covert, Michigan. Barbara, Malik, thank you so much, and please do take care.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all.
This week, Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel announced that her office would start paying more attention to long-term care facilities. State attorneys, she says, might take legal action against those that don't follow certain rules set by the governor this spring. That includes those nursing homes in which more than 2,000 residents have died from COVID-19. A little over a month ago, the state published a trove of reports about how well Michigan's nursing homes followed infection control procedures as the pandemic mounted. Michigan Radio's Will Callen has been following that story. Will, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, thanks, April.
What do the inspection reports tell us?
Yeah, so these reports are the most detailed account available to us of what it was like in nursing homes from the beginning of the pandemic through its most intense weeks in April. And in a lot of ways, they confirm stuff that we already knew. A lot of facilities were short-staffed, whether because they were going into the pandemic short-staffed or they started losing workers once people were getting sick. They didn't have access to PPE or testing. And I ended up going through reports for Michigan's regional hubs, which were these 21 facilities that the state health department selected for their ability to house and isolate COVID-19 patients who either couldn't recover safely in their nursing home of residence or were coming from the hospital and just not exactly ready to go home yet.
Well, how did the regional hubs do under the terms of this survey?
So most of them passed, but four facilities did not. And I talk about those specific places in an article on our website. But, you know, it's important to remember that this was before they were designated as hubs, but you know, nevertheless, at some homes, we have staff that are not wearing PPE. At others, you have patients with respiratory symptoms who are not being isolated right away. And overall, you just get this sense that among staff and administrators, there's this pretty widespread misunderstanding of how dangerous this virus could be.
Yeah. I mean, it's infection control is a fact of life at long-term facilities that kind of go through something similar to this on a smaller scale in flu season. But can you give us, were there any cases that stood out to you? Any examples you could give us of what this looked like?
Yeah. So one of the homes is Shorepoint Nursing Center, which is in St. Clair Shores. And there's this one account of a patient who came from the hospital with some respiratory symptoms. He was placed with a roommate, and both of them started developing more symptoms after that. Symptoms were worsening. They were eventually tested for COVID. And in the next few days, you know, without being isolated, one of them died in the facility. And then the other, after finally being isolated, he went to the hospital and he died. And so, you know, I talked to some experts about this. One of the really big problems here is that they failed to follow their own policy, which was that if a resident gets swabbed for COVID, they must be isolated right away. So yeah, this is a problem, but the people I spoke with also said, you know, you need time to teach staff about these policies. Catherine Heyer is one of those people. She's at the University of South Florida, and she studies long-term care in the U.S. generally.
To do these things well, to really implement a protocol well, you have to have time to do the training. You have to test. You have to, you know, watch people. You have to give them some time. And everybody's doing it as they're implementing.
So another example is at the MetaLodge of Livingston. We have one resident who tested positive for COVID, wasn't simply swabbed, but tested positive, and wasn't isolated for, you know, 8 days.
Oh, wow.
And at the MetaLodge of Frankenmuth, you have, they did have training programs, which is great, but they were pretty poorly attended. And it seems like that's because they weren't actually requiring that people attend these sessions. People may not have had time to attend these sessions. And, you know, as we know, in hindsight, at least, everyone really needed to be on the same page with a disease this dangerous.
I think part of what's so mind-blowing about this, Will, is that these hubs were the ones that were supposed to have infection control down, right?
Yeah, yes.
Well, why were they selected if they still had these problems?
So it seems like the health department didn't really have better options. Remember, the number one qualification for these hubs was bed space. And it turns out that facilities that have better ratings, they don't have a lot of room because people want to send their family members there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that means most of the hubs, they have a below average rating from the federal government. They have more health violations than other homes in Michigan. And in fact, all but one of them in the last 4 years have been cited for an infection control violation of some sort. And, you know, in May, we were talking about this with the state health department, and they told us that if there was a home that had infection control problems, they were probably minor enough that inspectors can clear them up. This is Brian Barry, who worked on selecting the hubs.
In some cases, our fears that a facility may or may not be able to successfully pull it off were allayed because the surveyors on site reassured us that they were able to adequately isolate the COVID residents.
Barry also told us then that facilities with recent cases of abuse against, you know, their elderly residents, that would immediately knock a home out of the running for regional hubs. But two of the homes were cited for abuse in the last year, in 2019. So many of the hubs had some sort of problem. This is not acceptable, but unfortunately it is pretty common. In 2019, 63% of Michigan's nursing homes had an infection control violation.
Do we know anything about how well these facilities were able to deal with infections once they became hubs?
We don't really, because the state data, the publicly available data for these particular facilities, it's not totally reliable. What we do know is that over the last couple months, the case and death rates in nursing homes have stayed relatively stable. They've both been rising, but pretty gradually, and it's certainly nothing like it was back in April and May. The health department did tell us that for the hubs, there have been in total about 1,200 admissions and 1,100 recoveries, which is somewhat encouraging. The good news is that we will know more about these hubs and nursing homes in general very soon, because at the end of August, there are two big reports that are supposed to come out, and one is looking at the regional hub policy in particular.
Michigan Radio's Will Callen. Will, I know this has been a pretty massive research project. Thank you for grinding through the reports for us.
Yeah, thank you, April.
You can read Will's article at the Michigan Radio website. For a lot of us, bourbon sounds like a slow sipping drink, maybe for a cooler day. But in our latest installment of Cheers, mixologist Tammy Coxon shows Lester Graham that bourbon can be well suited for summer cocktails as well. Grab a pencil. This next recipe is going to be good for your next online tiki party.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. And you have a bottle there that I really like. We visited Eastern Kill in Grand Rapids a while back. I actually bought a bottle of their rye, which was really delicious. You've got the bourbon.
That's right.
What are you using it in?
Well, I've been teaching these online cocktail classes because I had to figure out how to transition my business to being online. And the most recent one that I did was a summer bourbon cocktails class. And we think of bourbon drinks as kind of being those heavy sipping drinks.
Yeah, it's a winter drink.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Or fall, anyway.
Right. So this was like, what's the summer side of bourbon? You know that I am a fan of tiki drinks while being very aware of their complicated history. But that's definitely where my mind goes when I think about the summer.
Right. And just to clear up what you mean cultural appropriation issues and things like that.
Right.
So I understand that. But what I don't understand is I thought tiki drinks were pretty much made with rum.
Lots of people think that. But actually, other kinds of spirits have been part of the tiki tradition and the tropical drink tradition since the very beginning.
Okay, so what did you make with Eastern Kills bourbon?
So this is the Halekulani cocktail. It comes from the Halekulani Hotel in Waikiki Beach in Hawaii, and it was invented in the 1930s.
So oh, it's that old.
Right. So when I say that tiki tradition of non-rum spirits goes back a long time, it goes back to the very beginning. And this is a really, really interesting combination of ingredients, tons of different ingredients in here, so it's very much representative of the tiki tradition in that way, and they come together into this beautiful sum of its parts.
Is this something we can actually make at home?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
There's a couple ingredients you'll need to make yourself, but you can absolutely make this at home.
Let's hear about it.
So it has 1.5 ounces of bourbon, 1/4 ounce of a rich simple syrup, so that's been made with a demerara sugar in a 2-to-1 ratio with water. There's 1 teaspoon of grenadine, preferably a homemade grenadine, which is just pomegranate juice and sugar. And then it has 1/2 ounce each of pineapple juice, orange juice, and lemon juice, and 1 dash of Angostura bitters.
Well, that's not too bad.
Right. Shake that all up, but unlike a lot of tiki drinks that are served over crushed ice, this one is actually served strained and in a coupe.
Are there any kinds of bourbons we should avoid when making this drink?
I don't think so. I think lots of different kinds of bourbons would work. This is the second bourbon I've tried with it, and I think it's just as great both times.
Okay, I'm going to take a taste now. Is that okay?
Yeah, please.
Oh, I like the aroma
mm-hmm.
right away. Wow. Summer or winter, I would drink that. It's got a really citrusy end. So at the beginning, you get that big brown bourbon taste and the sweetness of the juices. And then at the end, it's just all a bit of citrus. And then it's done. It's gone. The finish is quick.
Well, and then also that Angostura bitters, though. That spice note kicks in there, too, which I think is why you said this could transition from fall to winter.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it was funny. The first time I made it, I thought when you read the recipe, you think that could taste a little bit sweet with all those sweet juices and the grenadine and the demerara syrup. But when I tasted it, I was like, whoa, one, this isn't sweet, and two, this is surprisingly complex. And then I looked at the recipe and I went, well, it has 7 ingredients in it. Of course it's a complex cocktail.
Well, it's really delicious as well. So what's the name of it again?
The Halekulani.
All right. I just want to say your online cocktail classes, I'm glad that's working out because I imagine it's kind of difficult to pitch a cocktail class when you can't taste the cocktail, but it's good that people are interested.
It's interesting. I took a little bit of time after the shutdown to think about what is it about my cocktail classes that people enjoy and how can I best translate that to the online experience. So people get to make whole drinks in their house and they really like that. They don't have to drive anywhere after, which is fantastic. And the thing I've always loved teaching in my classes and people have always loved hearing is about the history and the stories.
Right.
And those translate even better to the online format because we can use videos and pictures and slides and really make it an interactive experience. So I have people who tell me they like my online classes better than the in-person ones.
Well, cheers.
Cheers.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for being with us. Catch you next week.